rioters challenging the outnumbered police officers. He said it crossed the Rubicon at that point and the mob was pouring over the Capitol steps like water. The panel also heard from Caroline Edwards, a Capitol police officer who described in harrowing detail how she was assaulted by the mob, some armed with bats, clubs and even spray. Caroline Edwards said she was knocked unconscious on the steps and after she came to, she ran to the overwhelmed officers trying to stop insurrectionists breaking into the Senate. She said the scene was like a war zone and she was slipping on her fellow officers' blood. She added, "It was carnage, it was chaos." Drawing on the findings of the nearly year-long investigation, which includes more than 100 subpoenas, 1,000 interviews and 100,000 documents, the Select Committee will attempt to establish a comprehensive sequence of events that built to the cold January day when Donald Trump encouraged his supporters to fight like hell. The attack, which played out in real time on national television, left more than 100 police officers injured as they clashed with a pro-Trump mob. 9 people lost their lives in connection with the riot, including a woman who was fatally shot by a Capitol police officer as she attempted to breach the House chamber. Convincing a deeply polarized American public that the Capitol riot was not a spontaneous act of violence, but rather the culmination of a months-long plot by Donald Trump and his allies to undermine the results of the presidential election, is no easy task for the committee. Congressman Benny Thompson argued that American democracy remains in danger, as many Republicans at local and national level continue to boost the myth that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump and use it for their own election campaigns. Congressman Benny Thompson said the conspiracy to thwart the will of the people is not over. He said 6th of January and the lies that led to insurrection have put 2.5 centuries of constitutional democracy at risk. The world is watching what we do here, he said. The Select Committee is composed of 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans. Speaking with the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles, California, before the hearing on Wednesday, 8th of June, President Biden said the assault on the Capitol was a clear and flagrant violation of America's Constitution. He said a lot of Americans are going to see for the first time some of the details. Hundreds have been charged in connection with the events of 6th of January 2021, including some with seditious conspiracy. The hearings will resume in the coming days.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera.
Go deep.
Don't touch my camera.
You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior for women that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the US invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the US terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Mariam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials.
What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
We are visiting Afghan food markets, where prices are hiking day by day. Food items are short, and people don't have cash to buy them. Customers here tell us about their struggle to provide food and livelihoods.
If I save the whole salary of my 20 days of work, I will be able to buy a sack of flour, because I hardly can make only a dollar per day. However, most of the days, I'm without the job. In such a situation where prices are also skyrocketing, I can no longer provide livelihoods for my family.
On Wednesday, the UN chief said the impacts of the war in Ukraine have generated food and finance crises globally, with vulnerable ones being hit hard. Afghan experts say Afghanistan is among the countries affected harshly.
Previously, the prices of food items, including that of flour, were lower. Since the beginning of Russia-Ukraine conflict, the prices have started to rise. Then a sack of flour was $17, but now it is nearly $30. Unfortunately, our country is also facing an unprecedented drought that has a significant role in food shortages.
In the meantime, Afghan traders and businessmen also complain about the severe impacts of freezing Afghan assets by the U.S. and global sanctions on the country.
The U.S. seizing of Afghan assets has left a severe effect on our markets and livelihoods. Earlier, a dollar was exchanged with 77 Afghanis, but now, due to U.S. sanctions, a dollar has been raised to 89. We urge the U.S. and the international community to not add to the miseries of Afghan people and free their frozen funds as soon as possible.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. and allies froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets, and major funding to the country was halted. Sanctions and ripple effects from the war in Ukraine have triggered food crisis in Afghanistan. Most people here say they can afford a single sack of flour, since the prices have more than doubled. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by 0.25% next month, most likely 0.5% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I've had also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO.
ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then?
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Avdiivka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road, as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot.
These fighters are from the Donbas, now loyal to Russia. They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons are slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, it's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much needed comfort in this brutal war.
Now, Avdiivka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. And then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Avdiivka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this which will have to be taken as well.
The remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
That there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here, but I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
The majority of the EU's 705 legislators do support the 27-nation bloc's handling of the Ukraine conflict, but a growing minority are very unhappy. On the issue of sanctions, the EU has been accused of double standards and hypocrisy.
If Russia attacks Ukraine, there will be sanctions. When the US bombs Iraq, no sanctions. When Saudi Arabia bombs Yemen, no sanctions. When the EU destroys Libya, no sanctions. When Israel colonizes Palestine, no sanctions.
When dissenting voices in the European Parliament highlight Ukraine's history of corruption or the need for greater diplomatic efforts with Russia, they are often shut down.
Please, dear colleagues, try to do preventive diplomacy. As somebody who has gone through
you
the
have
war,
to come to
I know that war does not resolve anything. Thank you.
Mainly due to the conflict, energy and food prices continue to soar in the EU, placing enormous financial hardship on citizens. Despite this, it seems the focus remains fixed on weapons.
Our unprecedented military support package of 2 billion euros under the European peace facility helps Ukraine defend its population.
Some analysts blame NATO and the EU, directed by the United States, for provoking Russia into military action.
And now
For Ukraine, it's a very bad situation. For Russia also, and for Europe, it's a very bad situation.
Any of the 27 leaders in the EU can veto key policies in the European Council. For example, Hungary has been blocking a total ban on Russian oil imports. Some lawmakers want the veto option to be scrapped.
For 1 month, we put our indecisiveness out on full display. And what was the outcome? The perception that one member state won and the EU as a collective lost.
Other lawmakers disagree. They say it would be yet another example of the EU moving away from being a peace project and towards becoming a federalist superpower to benefit big business, including the arms industry. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
The UK has marked the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The royal family paraded the capital over the long bank holiday weekend, and Transport for London finally opened the long-awaited Elizabeth line. But strikes put a damper on things, with members of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, desperate for better pay, walked off the job. Rose works for TfL. After a long day on the picket line, she spoke at the People's Assembly. The cost of living crisis has hit hard, but who will bear the brunt?
This is affecting all working people of all different types in all parts of the country. And that means that we do have to come together. We do need to recognise that we are in this fight together.
The government must act. It must act to make sure that children aren't hungry. It must act to make sure that people don't lose their homes. It must act so that people can go on holiday. That's an important thing as well. And we're going to lose all of that across the next few months unless the government changes course.
The speakers insisted the key to success was unity. Massive rallies are being planned, and people from a myriad of causes will be attending.
We're in a situation now where, in the most serious cost of living crisis, the most serious attack on working people that there's been for generations, our government is considering increasing what is already a massive defence budget, a massive arms spending budget. And that seems to us to be completely absurd and actually disgraceful.
The speakers here today warned that dire poverty is knocking on the doors of millions of people across the UK, and the government has no intention of intervening. Record price hikes have already happened, and more is just around the corner.
Food, fuel, energy bills, mortgage premiums, national insurance contributions and tuition fees. You name it, the price has gone up. Politicians are blaming the UK's predicament on external factors.
But, Mr. Speaker, the war's most significant impact domestically is on the cost of living. COVID and global factors meant goods and energy prices were already high. Statistics published this morning show that inflation in February was 6.2%.
But during the same period, energy companies have reported record profits. City bonuses have gone up six times wages, and politicians have made it to the UK's rich list. Households have been promised a few hundred pounds in relief, but it won't even scratch the surface, as millions of families wonder where their next meal is coming from. Bianca Rahimi, London.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public health care has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good health care.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Palestinians protested in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, meaning the Day of Setback. Nakba Day refers to the defeat of Arab armies in the 1967 war, which saw Israel's complete occupation of Palestine and Al-Quds, as well as the displacement and dispossession of more Palestinians. In recent weeks, extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. During a press conference, Palestinian resistance factions vowed to continue on their path of resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The criminal Zionist enemy must understand that the Palestinian people will always protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Palestinian people will sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds. Aggression against Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds will only happen over the dead bodies of Palestinians.
Nakba Day came just 19 days after Nakba Day of 1948, which saw the forceful displacement and disposition of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians upon the creation of the Israeli regime. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
As we mark the 55th anniversary of the Zionist aggression of 1967, we assert that we will continue to fight for the sake of liberating Al-Quds, the eternal capital of Palestine. There is no such thing as Zionist sovereignty over Al-Quds or over Palestine. Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa, and Palestine belong to the Palestinian people.
Decades on, Palestinians have been trying to liberate their occupied lands by all forms of resistance.
As they mark the 55th anniversary of Nakba Day, Palestinians in Gaza say they will continue to resist the Israeli occupation until the liberation of their land. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert, facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or goods, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country express concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60-70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Again, the Western bloc, including the U.S. and the U.K. Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on six key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. Let me refer to some of the points mentioned in Imam Khomeini's testament, which is full of useful meaning. The first point is that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi insisted in his testament on the fact that the Islamic revolution is a divine revolution, and it is mainly based on the will of the people. The Islamic revolution belongs to the people. This means that no individual, social class, or group can and should claim to be the owner of this revolution and consider others as a subsidiary. If anyone was to claim to the owner of this revolution, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was the most suitable person who was deserving of ownership. This revolution was due to his determination and personality, but Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi considers his own role as very little and considers the revolution as a blessing from God. This is a predominant theme in Imam Khomeini's statements, which has also been stressed and specified in his testament. Therefore, it is the people who are the owners of this revolution. Protecting this divine gift is a duty that lies upon everyone's shoulders.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The people must consider themselves as the guardians of the revolution. The identity and significance of the revolution are due to its principles, orientations, and values. There have always been, and there will always be, some individuals who have tried to change the revolutionary ideas under the pretext that the conditions have changed. They have tried to separate the aspects related to religion and social justice from the revolution. They have tried to make the revolution devoid of its tendency to fight outsiders, hegemony, and autocracy. They may step into the ring with various motives and under various pretexts to change the revolutionary slogans and aspirations. The people have to be alert. They must know that this revolution is alive due to its values. Being Islamic, adhering to religious principles, opposing hegemony and arrogance, and supporting the oppressed sincerely and openly all over the world are the most essential values among the slogans written on the revolutionary flag.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. On Wednesday, the IAEA Board of Governors passed a resolution against Iran accusing Tehran of not cooperating with the UN nuclear watchdog. Iran has responded to the move by beginning to inject uranium gas into advanced centrifuges and disconnecting some IAEA cameras monitoring its sites outside the safeguards agreement. And now France, Britain, and Germany have condemned steps taken by Iran, saying the move has cast a doubt on Tehran's will to revive the JCPOA. In this edition of the Spotlight, we'll try to take a closer look at the recent anti-Iran resolution and Tehran's response, as well as the Europeans' Troika statement. On this edition of Spotlight, we have... Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas, joining us from Islamabad. And political commentator Frank Emspach, joining us from Boston.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Sayed Mohsen Abbas in Islamabad. Cooperation between Iran and the IAEA has taken a turn for the worse following the recent anti-Iran resolution. Given Iran's previous cooperation with the IAEA, does Iran have every reason to be outraged by the IAEA's accusation of lack of cooperation from Tehran?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, it's totally against the norms of any kind of, fair-minded or just approach by an institution, an internationally recognized institution like the IAEA, to be going around running in Israel, which is, a diametrically opposed force to the Islamic Republic in the region. So that was really very, very improper, to say the very least. And so the Iranians have got every right to be dismayed at that action in itself. But of course, what Europe and what America have been doing from day dot, since the day they signed originally this JCPOA agreement, is they've been flagrantly violating it. I don't think there's been any stage where these particular signatories to the JCPOA have actually done anything to abide by even that agreement which they signed. So the Europeans are not really much better than the Americans. The Americans walked out under Trump, which was, you know, absolutely mind-boggling the way they did that without any discussion whatsoever. That was ridiculous enough. But then the Europeans went into this song and dance about creating INSTEX and creating means of being able to help Iran to trade in the meantime without all these sanctions that were imposed, but that came to really nothing. There was just all talk. So Europe and the European signatories to this document have proved themselves to be essentially a paper tiger, and worse still, really just the tail of a tiger, to be honest. And the Americans have proved that they have no decisive leadership around this issue. They dropped the issue really at the moment, which is blocking the whole idea of the agreement, is really that they aren't willing to drop the IRGC from the State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Again, the first time I've ever heard of a military being condemned as a terror organization. But anyway, they did it. Trump did it. Biden hasn't backed off from it. And the compromise that was actually behind the scenes mooted was that the IRGC should be delisted and the Quds force actually wouldn't. So Iran's kind of foreign force would remain on that list. But Biden is so weak and so scared of the Zionist lobby, he's not even attempted to try and come to some sort of compromise around this. And so one can only say that the actions of Trump and his withdrawal were reckless, but the actions of Biden and the current regime and the Europeans are really just equally feckless and reckless as well. The result is that the maximum pressure which Mr. Trump instituted and which Mr. Biden has continued with glee have had no effect, and they are failing. They will fail. They'll sure. continue to strengthen Iran. So really, it's a failure in statecraft on the part of the Europeans and the Americans.
Frank Emspach in Boston, Iran's nuclear chief, has warned that Iran's response to the resolution will be, quote, firm and proportionate. As we know, Iran has already taken retaliatory measures, including installation of advanced centrifuges and turning off some of the agency's surveillance cameras. Iran has informed the IAEA of its plans to remove all extra surveillance cameras installed under the 2015 deal, cameras that were there as a goodwill gesture beyond the safeguards agreement. In your opinion, are these moves justified now?
Well, I think they've been justified in a certain sense for a long time. The United States unilaterally withdrew from this agreement. The Europeans said, we'll support the agreement, we signed it, and then they didn't do it. So the Iranians were left out in the cold economically and politically. Their leadership had bet a lot on the agreement. Meanwhile, Israel and others are working to undermine it, and the IAEA has done nothing to deal with Israeli nuclear weapons. So you have this situation where the Western countries, the Europeans, have lost all credibility. But let's put this also in another context. Today, there is a meeting of South American and Central American countries under the leadership of the United States in Los Angeles. And Venezuela is not there. They were not invited. And as a result of that, Mexico and others pulled out. Venezuela, as I understand it, is now in Iran. The president is in Iran. And so what we're having here is a challenge to the United States' hegemony in diplomatic affairs. And, of course, an economic challenge, because what has happened here is that Iran has survived. It has been able to sell oil. It is working with the Chinese. The Russians and the Chinese, for instance, did not agree with the IEA. So there is a shift going on here. And the sanctions that the United States has been using are showing a degree of ineffectiveness. Not that they're totally ineffective, it certainly hurt people, but they're not accomplishing what the U.S. wanted. Meanwhile, internally to this country, there is no major force within the Democratic Party, which is the ruling party at the moment, fighting for this treaty. There are certain individuals and there are certain leaders, but overall, Biden has backed away from this, and I think the commentator prior to me was correct, out of fear that he will be charged by the Republicans with somehow losing Iran or being appeasing the Iranians or whatever, and thereby weakened even further. So it's a very dangerous situation, particularly also today. The papers announced that the Israelis were meeting with the Saudis about security issues, whatever that means, but it probably means Iran being targeted. So it's a very, very dangerous situation, it seems to me.
Said Mohsen Abbas, the Iranian nuclear chief has sharply criticized the IAEA agents, the International Atomic Energy Agency, warning that the IAEA is caught in the clutches of Zionists. Now, given Rafael Grossi's visit to Israel prior to the meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors, would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I think anybody who has any real in-depth analysis about the way the international order or the world is set up will understand very much that it's a combination of the Atlantic powers and the states and their economic, backing, added to transnational corporate power and their financial backing, which actually keeps these kinds of institutions like the IAEA or the WHO or any of these other huge kind of international level organizations, the United Nations, various others, you know. And once you have finances coming from a particular source, backing supposedly neutral, benign institutions that are meant to try and solve problems or keep an eye on trouble and really protect the world from Armageddon, in the case of IAEA, you find that there's actually a sort of compromise and a sort of a clash of interests and a compromise in the actual authenticity and honesty and integrity of these institutions. The IAEA is no different. They have been seen constantly to compromise their role. The most obvious one is that, for instance, they don't check up on the Saudi Arabian development of nuclear weapons, which is being fully pushed and supported by the Americans. Several companies that have even tendered, bids to go into Saudi Arabia and to start developing their nuclear power. Now, again, Saudi Arabia is another primary antagonist of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So why the JCPOA and why such scrutiny on Iran when actually on the other side, the IAEA knows full well that the Saudis are being pushed towards nuclear arms and development as well. Israel is the other obvious case, you know, since it's had nuclear weapons and since everybody knows the biggest open secret, Mr. Vananu blew it open back in the day. But since then, where is the IAEA in pushing Israel to join the non-proliferation treaty? Where is the IAEA in its demands to go and check out the Dimona nuclear sites in Israel? Do they have any monitoring? No, they don't. So there you see, just with two examples, you can see that there are double standards and this hypocrisy, which, you know, stinks to high heaven. And there is a serious threat of global confrontation and conflict and real Armageddon because of this bias. This is the problem, that the more that organizations like the IAEA kowtow to the Americans, kowtow to the Israelis with exceptionalism, and at the same time act in a belligerent way to the likes of Iran, the more chance there is of war.
Mr. Ansbach, I want to get your perspective on that issue. Why was the IAEA chief in Israel? Why the Israeli regime itself is a violator of the IAEA's rules?
Well, I can't speak for the IAEA, but I can speak when we look at the role of the United States here. The United States is the prime economic financier of Israel for a whole variety of different reasons. And the United States has been quite clear that it will veto or prevent in any forum, at any level, any investigation of Israeli nuclear availability or possibilities. So the IAEA falls within that. You know, one maneuver or another within the IAEA prevents it from going forward. And the inability or the unwillingness of the Europeans to declare independence from the United States in this regard simply reinforces the situation. And I think, again, it's a very dangerous situation. We do not, the United States government, within this country, there is not a political force of significance that's a bit, that can take on the Israeli lobby and the Zionist position here. And I think although that is changing somewhat, it is by nowhere near a strong enough current to force changes in American foreign policy. And so until that happens, the United States as the main financier of Israel, never mind the subsidiary agencies in the United Nations, is simply not going to permit the IAEA to do anything. And I think that's clear. However they do it, it's not important, but that is the end result.
Said Mohsen Abbas, you mentioned Europe a little earlier, but let's really focus on Europe's role. The E3, that's Britain, France, and Germany, all parties to the 2015 Iran deal. They say Iran's actions cast doubt on its commitments to revive the nuclear deal. What about all of Europe's shortcomings in the implementation of the JCPOA in the first place?
Well, exactly. The sad conclusion is really that the EU, despite its promises and all its kind of supposed goodwill, it was unable to negate the punitive US actions at all. And again, the EU has failed to achieve anything spectacular, even through the Joint Comprehensive Action Plan, as it was laid out. I mean, it was meant to be, let's not forget, a flagship foreign policy achievement of the EU and a common foreign policy. And it was a symbol of the organization's growing strength, apparently. And in fact, what's really come out is that the EU is still just a paper tiger. It has no military force on the ground. It's a lackey of America in NATO, even in the so-called aggression by the Russians. It's actually the Americans who've pushed the EU into a situation where, again, they're the ones who are getting hit by all the oil and the potential economic disaster, while the Americans are using them there as well. And the same goes here, that there's no real benefit for the EU in terms of sanctioning Iran. In fact, companies like Total and many others were in there beginning to build relationships with Iran, which is a huge economy. I mean, the Iranians, let's not forget, have just signed a £600 million deal with China and strengthening the Eurasian bloc, which is going to become the major, if you like, economic challenge for European and Western economic hegemony, if you like. So you would have thought that the EU would have been thinking about at least trying to break up the Eurasian alliance, or at least getting a piece of the pie. Nothing doing. They're too scared that if they did anything in Iran, essentially all their trade with America and all the restrictions and control, excuse me, that they have would cost the corporate companies hugely, and also cost Europe as a group of nations. So they're too scared to take on America at the moment, and I'm afraid that they've really just relinquished all sense of justice, and they've weighed in with the Americans and have just played the good cop, which actually is really totally on America's side. And the result of it, in conclusion, I'd just like to say that basically, you know, the economic deprivation has only hit the Iranian people, not the establishment. So first of all, your maximum pressure, which the Europeans fell in line with America, hasn't really stopped Iran being whatever, you know, they objected to in the first place. The Europeans, God knows what that is, but it's, they have an objection with the actual whole political system and the governance as it stands. And they interfere regularly, creating color revolutions to that end. And the Europeans are involved in this as well. Also, the fissile material, they say themselves now that Iran, because of all this nonsense they've done around the JCPOA, Iran is capable of producing fissile material that could produce a nuclear weapon. Ayatollah Khamenei has said over and over again that on a spiritual, religious, and moral, ethical basis, Iran does not want to make weapons. That means something in Iran when the Imam Khamenei says that. But of course, now the Iranians definitely have the ability. They want to use that ability for peaceful means. They say that.
Okay.
And there are incentives for them to do that if the JCPOA and trade, et cetera, was opened up. But the way that the Europeans and the Americans have played it, all they've done is made the whole region more dangerous. They've allowed this sparring to start take place between Israel and Iran, and it's actually pushed everything to a much more volatile and potentially warlike footing.
Frank M. Spack, Britain, France, and Germany presented this anti-Iran resolution to the IAEA. Iran's foreign minister says that such behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal. Do you believe the E3 countries were again following the U.S.'s lead by conjuring and presenting the anti-Iran resolution to the IAEA? As we know, the independence of Europe regarding Iran's nuclear deal has always been a subject of speculation.
Well, I'm not sure that the United States called them up and said, hey, let's this week. I think in each of those societies, there was significant opposition to the treaty in the first place. I think what's happening here, though, is that within each of those societies, the real role of the progressive parties or the social democratic parties or the more liberal organizations is really in question here, because they're unable, apparently, to control the dialogue, because all of these parties have said they favor the treaty. And so it appears that they're not really able to control the discussion or to insist that their governments live up to the treaty. And I think that mirrors the situation in the United States, where within the Democratic Party, there are some people who support the boycott, divest movement of people to go after, to raise these issues with Israel and to force them into a treaty, but they're a small minority. So I don't know that you have to have somebody call up and say, do this. You have conservative organizations, conservative leadership, basically in a certain sense, pro-NATO, maybe even pro-war leadership in some of these countries. And so they don't need to be told what to do. The only question here is Macron, who keeps writing articles about it necessary to have French independence.
Okay.
But if it comes down to it, that independence disappears.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joining us from Islamabad. Political commentator Frank M. Spack joining us from Boston. Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us here on Spotlight. And, of course, thanks for staying with us on the program.